Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Enterprise Dish. Well, you may or may not have gone anywhere. We are still sitting in the same spots, although Rick is once again on my, I won't say the actual name of the list, but it's the bad list, because I think, at least for the second time in recent memory, you have been to a golf mecca that I have not been to, and it makes me... Rick literally sent me a picture. He's like, look at this thing. I'm like, Rick...
Yeah, and you're going to tell me about it. The envy list, I guess. Let's call it that.
Yeah. So where'd you go, Rick?
So, it's difficult this year, right? As everybody, I'm sure, has dealt with. But my wife and I learned a long time ago to take good vacations. And we had to move vacations and change vacations. But the one vacation we do that's just her and I, we kept this year, and we adjusted it a little bit, but usually it's just her and we have, you know, care for the kids and all. We're not just leaving. Mm-hmm. But anyways, we went to Northern California, and we were in like the coastal, like Carmel, Monterey, Santa Cruz, all the way down to Cambria, that real majestic Pacific Coast Highway. And it's this little, you know, that game where they hit the stick with that little like textured ball. You know, I can't remember the name.
One of the oldest games to ever exist, golf.
Oh, that thing, yes. Yeah. Which is hilarious because last year we did a call. I was at Torrey Pines.
That's the other one, yep.
Near San Diego. And this year, Pebble Beach up there in that area, really close to where we stayed. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is, Brad, I'm not a golf person or a golf fan.
I'm just dying on the inside. Don't mind me.
And I'm like, oh, this looks pretty nice. You know, I admire beautiful places.
Yeah.
And it was quite beautiful. But, you know, you wouldn't have liked it. It was windy that day, you know. So
oh, yeah, I'm sure it was just terrible. Rick, I would play that course in a lightning storm. Let's just be clear.
Yeah, I went to the gift shop, and my father-in-law, he likes this stuff, so we're holding it up. Mm-hmm. I'm like, would he like this one, or would he like that one, you know? So we bought a towel, you know, I guess. Yep. You can put that on your golf bag. Mm-hmm. You know, so they had very nice, the gift shop, the pro shop was really nice stuff. They had the, what's that trophy, that big, you know?
Oh, the big, oh God, what's the name of the, I know what
winners
you're talking
about. Winners Champions Trophy, yep. Whatever, yep. Champions Cup, they had that, kind of a wall of fame, little practice green, had some people, some really fancy dogs putting, like with their little dog, that was weird. But anyways, golf place, not a golf tourist, but it was in this scenic drive, and it's like, oh, yeah. Check it out. I sent you a picture.
Yep. Appreciate it. There's another couple.
Time.
Yeah, it's a beautiful area. I've never been there personally. I've been close, but I've yet to make it there. And then there's also Spyglass, which is another really famous golf course. I think you can see it from Pebble, I think, because it's like across the bay. Anyways.
Yeah, there's other golf courses that were of that. I only wanted to rub it in once, but yeah.
We'll just keep moving on. Anyways, so things that are happening in the Azure, I was going to say the Azure sphere, but this is sort of happening outside of the sphere of the Earth, is that Microsoft announced a new partnership with SpaceX, and they've been launching up satellites like crazy, and they are, it looks like it's just going to be sort of, I don't know if CDN is the right word to use here, but it's definitely going to be able to use their services to connect Azure data centers online, as more than likely, I'm guessing, like a redundancy connection. But, you know, just another partnership up for the Microsoft and Azure.
You know, I saw this connectivity option, mm-hmm. and I thought that was really interesting. I almost feel like this is going to be a gateway to other things.
Yeah.
You know, so things like you could have floating Azure centers. There could be an orbital Azure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there could be, I hate to say it, you know, imagine an access point for connectivity in space for satellites, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of things you could do with this. Relays to orbitals, right, in the mm-hmm. moon, you know, Azure moon region or whatever. So it kind of becomes, actually, the cloud isn't quite a broad enough term.
Yeah.
So we need something bigger.
I was just trying to think of, like, what would be the disk storage tier for, like, storage and compute in low Earth orbit, like Can you? I don't even want to think about what that would cost, but I understand your point. Like, you have two satellites, they're gathering data, and it needs fast compute, and it needs instantaneous response, and rather than beaming it down and back up, it just, you know, it's passed through whatever little Azure thing, and there you go.
Maybe you could get Wi-Fi hotspot or some sort of set up a service point there, you know. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe the ISS wants some extra connectivity. I don't know. There's a lot of things you could do with that, but I think it's actually, it's rather groundbreaking, and it's rather awesome as well.
I would call it like skybreaking, not groundbreaking.
Oh, I would call it space breaker.
Space breaker. Well, the other thing that they did announce too are these Azure modular data centers. They kind of looks like Connex containers, and they put, it's like, it's almost like an all-in-one solution, right? It's got cooling, it's got connectivity, it's got, you know, IOPS in it. You've got your compute, you've got your storage. And basically what it looks like is that if you don't have compute close enough to where you need, and like the little edge components aren't big enough or whatever, you just get a U-Haul or whatever, and you throw one of these things on the back and just dump it in the field, and you got Azure in a container.
Yeah, I think that's actually another really interesting use case. If you think about seasonal scenarios. I'm just making stuff up. Yeah. That's what we usually do. Let's take, you know, places that have very short but busy seasonal demands, like maybe tourism in Alaska, mm-hmm. or a construction project, yep. or maybe a mining expedition, you know, mm-hmm. just things like that where, you know, you could really benefit from that, and you might not have mainstream resources available, or the mm-hmm. latency gets in the way, that type of stuff, yeah. right? So you could get your mod on with your modular data center and solve some of those problems. Yeah, I saw that tweet, and I can't remember. That was definitely post-Ignite, but mm-hmm. very, very big news for sure.
One of the interesting scenarios, too, that was pitched to me by Microsoft about it, although they didn't actually say this is happening, they said, look at an oil rig, for an example. This is the type of thing that could quite literally be flown out to an oil rig, placed on there. They could do all their compute and data center activities localized, potentially using now their new SpaceX connection, beam it back up, and then you have like the whole robust solution on site. And in a way that can be upgraded too. I think that was sort of their bigger pitch, is that a lot of times oil rigs, you know, they last a long time. And if you drag a whole bunch of computers out there, they're kind of just built in. And in this way, you could just design it to just drop one of these things in, and there you go.
Yeah, oil rigs would be a good use case. You could also think about ships, right? Yeah. They have interesting needs, and, you know, especially, well, there's not a lot of it going on now, but cruise ships, right? Mm-hmm. They don't actually need a lot of technology, but they need it on board. I mean, yeah. and the occasional connectivity, transactional stuff. So yeah, I do think there's use cases. And then potentially you could even work in scenarios for underdeveloped mm-hmm. nations and yeah. things like that. Yeah. Maybe I hate to throw this out, like a war recovery, or, you know, mm-hmm. natural disaster recovery scenario where, you know, the city's infrastructure is destroyed or something like that. It kind of almost feels like a cloud equivalent of what Cisco's done with their TACOps. You know, they have, Cisco have these kind of emergency response technologies on both coasts of the U.S. where they drive these trucks in, and you've got connectivity, you've got a cell tower, you've got, you know, the communication, because a lot of times in post-natural disasters,
sure.
communication is actually the most important thing, the most important service that you can reinstate. And that, you know, if you think about the compute, the cloud, right, and technology, that actually becomes a natural kind of first scenario as well. So yeah, the modular data center can have a lot of use cases. You know, I could think about military bases. I could think about, you know, take Azure GovCloud is great until we're talking about something remote and far and, mm-hmm. you know, not in Northern Virginia. So
there are a lot of places besides Northern Virginia, like Pebble Beach. And
yeah.
On to the questions, Rick. We actually have two questions, and one of the second question, which Rick already knows what it is, I've been asking to all of the co-hosts, just kind of, you know, landscaping the environment, looking at the environment of how each of you all approach password management, I should say. But before we get to there, we had a question come in from a listener. It says, we have about a decade of tape storage, and I'm and I desperately want to move off of this system for something on premises that is not tape, and we have had recovery issues with tape in the past. Is there any suggestion from Rick about how I can get away from this medium, his recommendation for migration path, and what we do with all these years of tape?
Well, this is a tough one, right? So I'll first of all admit, everyone has a story of tape letting them down.
Mm-hmm.
On the same side, tape has a really good acquisition cost aspect and has really good portability. It's also really good to be resilient against ransomware, especially when you think about worm media. Now, that being said, I talk to organizations all the time who are moving to disk-based backup and moving away from tape, but you have this 10 years of retention that you probably didn't do by accident. It's probably more a business requirement, and it's predicated that you do that. So a couple suggestions. One, there's a huge direction now for what I'm going to call unified storage on premises. So the unified storage, if you and I, Brad, were having this conversation like 10, 15 years ago, if I said unified storage, that would be like a device that would give me, say, a fiber channel or maybe an iSCSI LUN, mm-hmm. but also could host out an SMB share, like a Windows file share. So it's block and file, it's unified. Well, today, when you say unified storage, that may be true, but then also there's object storage exposed to that. So there's actually an incredible market of on-prem unified storage systems that include object storage. You know, a couple right off the top of my head are like, you know, Wasabi, Scality, Cloudian. Then some of them may also be mm-hmm. consumable on the internet. Hitachi have them. Drawing a blank from the long list, but there are a lot. EMC Isilon, for example, that's an enterprise one. They can provide what I would call S3 compatible storage, but it's not the AWS public S3. Or you could even go into something like Azure Stack with blob storage, which you can consume and manage on premises, right? So you could look into like an Azure deployment, and there's shed load. That's not a cuss word, by the way, but there's a lot of services with Azure Stack, mm-hmm. but the blob engine would be the use case that would maybe, you know, drive and consume some resources here. So I would pursue an on-prem unified object storage resource, because, you know, if you've got that much data, I wouldn't want to just put that, you know, create a multi-petabyte, you know, LUN or file share and get into that. The numbers almost predicate exclusively that we're dealing with object storage at that point. Mm-hmm. And if this reader is very seriously wanting to straight up migrate that data, potentially I would rehydrate it and back it up the new way and store it on that object storage so that because the thing is, you know, no backup product is ever going to pick up another backup from another product.
Yeah.
So I feel like you almost need to retain the data in that regard. So think about extracting what you'd need on the new media and, you know, making that available and protected. And, you know, sometimes the cloud just kind of, even though the request was for on-premises, you can get into the cloud model mm-hmm. without necessarily going to the cloud location. And that's kind of the takeaway. So unified storage could be your friend.
There you go. If nothing else, hopefully that gives some options and like some different ways of thinking about it. Because clearly, while we don't know the exact depth and breadth of this project, it sounds like it's pretty significant and not something you're just going to hash together in a weekend.
Yeah, and I'd be a little cautious on like parts of that, because again, it's probably a compliance or a business rule that 10 mm-hmm. year mark is kept.
Yep.
You know, you could get into keeping the tape mechanism for those 10 years, but you might also be in a situation where you're forecasting a bigger problem. And I'll tell you a quick cheeky story about that. I spoke to someone who at the time was a CIO of a college, and in the basement, they had these old, the reel to reel, like big tapes mm-hmm. like that. And a student made a request for a transcript because they were going to finish their degree or get a an additional post-baccalaureate degree. I can't remember the scenario, but that student was before the mainframe. You know, so they had the data, but then they went, you know, somebody from the 40s or whatever wants their transcript.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do? And, you know, or whatever the first digital bit before it was a system that, you know, is in use now. They went down and got this big media and they're like, well, where are we going to hook this up?
Yeah.
You know, you get into these very expensive forensic data recovery scenarios that it may be worth at the time that you make this decision. So now to say, look, if I put this on something that's forward looking, like a cloud storage engine or another disk system that, you know, I plan on supporting for the future, I can read now, that type of stuff. And, you know, you could also make the case of, if it's literally something that you just can't delete, I know that the request was on premises, but I'd really look into something like Azure Cool Archive or Amazon Glacier, you know, one of those really cheap and deep. And, you know, we have a phrase internally here at Veeam is write once, read never, but never say never. Let's go
never say never.
We laugh at that stuff.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's. Yeah. I mean, that's the hope, right? The hope is that your backup is always there and it's really robust and it's super accessible when you need it, but you never have to touch it.
Indeed. But if you need it, it's there.
But if you need it, it is there. Speaking of there, Rick, without hopefully breaching any HR or IT policies, what is Veeam's philosophy on passwords? How does your company approach password lifecycle, password management? Do you have to change your password? Do you use password managers throughout your day? Or just generally, what is Veeam, the IT overlords? I know you are rogue, but cooperative, as you like to say.
I like that. That's right.
But what are the IT overlords at Veeam require from passwords, and how do they manage that process?
Well, you know, like any company, I think we're expanding that and adjusting to current conditions, right? I want to say it was middle of last year we implemented two-factor authentication across the board.
Yep.
And we have a lot, before current conditions, we have a lot of people that worked remote. So that was a big deal. I do still go into the office. As you can see, the lights automatically
I just
turn
saw that.
Off.
Yep.
So it's, you know, it's safe and legal for me to do that. But we do have a mechanism where it's like, if you're remote, you have to use the two-factor authentication. And we run through a normal rotation. I want to say it's 45, 60-day password change requirement. You know, complexity, right? But two-factor is really the jam. That's I'd actually argue that's more important than a password policy. You could have no factor, but if, or, you know, you could have two factor with really inferior passwords, and that's actually more resilient. And that second factor mechanism is really important. I look to, like, for example, I've turned on two-factor authentication for my own personal Azure subscription, which, you know, I can do one of two ways. Now, the funny thing is, I personally don't like the Authenticator app, which is a common way to do that.
Really? Interesting. I love the Authenticator app.
I do the phone call. Or
really?
The text.
See, here's the reason why I love it. And I think I probably know why you don't like it. So if you have an Apple Watch, it puts a notification on your wrist and you just hit accept and then it's done. You don't have to pull your phone out of your pocket, nothing.
Okay. I like it because I use the phone number, and now they actually recommend we use the app, but I still use the phone number. I use it because there are scenarios where I may not be able to get to that. And this actually was really when I was traveling, and I probably shouldn't say this on air, but I will. But basically, a lot of times if I had like in-flight Wi-Fi, now, the Authenticator app would work fine if I was using my phone on the in-flight Wi-Fi, but what if I wasn't?
Yeah.
So I would be on in-flight Wi-Fi, and I put my Google Voice number in, and I can answer the call in Google Voice. Now, it's illegal on the plane to talk, but I would just hit the pound key.
Yeah.
You know, so I could authenticate with just the laptop.
Okay.
No So I'm actually not really that secure in that regard, but I like two-factor authentication above all, whatever way is the right way for one to do that. I think that two-factor may not even be enough anymore. I've spoken to a lot of organizations, and I hate to keep, you know, diverting to ransomware, but that's one of the most effective resiliency techniques for ransomware. Password, a single factor of password is not enough that for that threat. Mm-hmm. So, and that you have to take that into consideration, because the two-factor authentication should be everywhere, because the reality is if something is in, it's in, and then everything else is at risk. So you kind of need these layers of two-factor all over the place. So that's my big mindset. We've implemented that at Veeam. We've implemented this in terms of recommendations for how we deploy our software. So I've used a phrase recently, 2FA all the way every day, something like that.
That's a good shirt right there to wear to a conference, right?
Yeah. And the thought here is that you need that level of resiliency. And actually, I got to give a shout out to IDC, the analyst firm. They published their 2021 predictions. And I'm right on it today. And just to log in and download a free white paper, they needed it, which I thought, you know, props to IDC. You know?
Interesting.
I don't mind the hassle of two-factor authentication myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can agree with that. I mean, especially for anything that has any semblance of sensitive data, I think it's definitely worthwhile to go down that path and just kind of get into the habit.
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, Rick, it has been like 30 minutes somehow, some way. You got anything?
You get me talking. No,
but that's good, though. It didn't even feel like 30 minutes. It only felt like an hour. I'm just kidding. Anything else you got for us, my guy, before we shut her down?
No, just hope the listeners are doing well in current conditions. You know, we're getting ready to round out the year. I think everybody's ready for that. Don't know if 2021 will be any different, but we'll see. But
we can, I don't even want to say this out loud. I was going to say it can't be any worse, but knock on wood, it's going to be better. It's going to be better. That's all I'm going to say. And there to everybody else, you can find links. You can find Rick information down below if you want to reach out for a contact. You can find our Twitter handles and everything else. Hit that subscribe button. We'll catch everybody right back here next time.